The idea of AI transforming occupational therapy stirs both hopes and fears. Will AI help us revolutionize our broken systems? Will it augment the best of our care? Or will it bolster inequality and threaten our jobs? This is a story we are actively writing and have the power to shape. In this one-hour CEU course, we will talk to two leading voices on the adoption of AI into occupational therapy, Allison Stover and Karen Jacobs. We'll discuss how they are currently using AI, what they are learning, and the opportunities for OT in what is shaping up to be the revolution of our lifetime. So let's dive in. Welcome to the OT Potential Podcast, where we review new and influential OT journal articles, then invite on an expert guest to help us pull out actionable takeaways that you can implement in your practice starting today. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Sarah Lyon, OTRL. And before we dive into this big, big topic of OT and AI hopes and fears, I wanted to let you know that this podcast may qualify as continuing education for you. You are probably listening to this podcast on a free podcast platform, but to gain CEU credit, you will need to be a member of the OT Potential Club, our OT continuing education platform. Bearing in mind that this episode could count as a CEU course, I wanted to state our two learning objectives so you can be thinking about them throughout the podcast today. Our first learning objective is you will be able to identify AI applications for OT treatment that are on the market. Second, you will be able to recognize simple steps for how an individual OT practitioner can help shape the future of OT and AI. If you are a regular listener to our podcast, you know that we usually kick off our episode by reviewing a new journal article. But given the quickly evolving nature of AI and OT practice, we are taking a different approach today. Our two guests are in the middle of collecting data for a new research project on OT and AI. Allison's clinic is using a brand new application called Coro, and Karen is researching it. So we are just going to go ahead and dive right into this timely conversation. Allison Stover, MOT, JD, OTRL, BCP, serves as the president of the American Occupational Therapy Association. A childhood trauma introduced Allison to the power of occupational therapy, and a subsequent lifetime of study and practice convinced her that consumer advocacy was every bit as essential as her technical practice of occupational therapy. Now, Allison and her husband own a private outpatient pediatric practice in a rural county in Pennsylvania and co-founded a nonprofit organization that uses occupation to address community, societal, and population needs. She currently serves as the director of clinical services and continues to practice as an occupational therapist for capable kids. Additionally, Allison is an associate professor in the Department of Occupational Therapy at the University of Pittsburgh, where she also obtained her Juris Doctorate in Law and a postgraduate certificate in health law. Karen is the Associate Dean for Digital Learning and Innovation at Boston University. She is also Program Director for Boston University's online post-professional OTD. Karen's research and scholarly pursuits examine the interface between the environment and human capabilities. In particular, she is investigating the individual factors and environmental demands associated with increased risk of functional limitations among populations of university and middle school age students. Her research has been supported by grants from the National Institute on Disability and Rehabilitation Research, the Office Ergonomics Research Committee, and the Harvard NIOSH Education and Research Center, as well as gifts from Hewlett-Packard and Microsoft. Karen is a past president and vice president of the American Occupational Therapy Association. So without further ado, I will invite our two guests onto our podcast. Allison and Karen, I am so, so thankful to have you here today to talk about this incredibly important topic. I'm going to have you both introduce yourselves so we can connect your voice with the bio that I just read. Karen, why don't you start us off?
Hi, I'm Karen Jacobs, and I'm in the Boston, New Hampshire area right now.
And I'm Allison Stover, and I'm actually in San Antonio, Texas right now, but just taking a quick trip to see some fun occupational therapy outside of Pennsylvania.
That's awesome. This topic of AI just feels so important right now. It feels like it's moving so fast. I'm so thankful for this conversation because this feels like a critical window almost to be talking about what do we want AI to look like in occupational therapy? What do we want our role to be to look like? And from both of you, I just want to hear how you're processing this change too. That's a lot intellectually to keep up with, but I think it's also a lot just emotionally to keep up with. So I'm so curious to hear what's going on inside your brain about this big topic. I want to start off with just asking what your aha moment was when you realized how important this AI movement was going to be for occupational therapy. Again, Karen, let's start with you.
Sure. Thank you. And Sarah, thank you for having us on your podcast. An aha moment regarding the potential of AI in absolutely transforming occupational therapy was actually during a session at Allison's clinic, Capable Kids, where one of her occupational therapy practitioners was using Coro AI, which is a platform that's data-driven AI tool to access and assess children in the clinic. Now, Allison is conducting research with me, and I'll talk about that a little bit later. But the Coro AI analyzed the child's movement using computer vision. And what was amazing to me was to put an iPhone in particular in front of the child where we could see objective data in detail far beyond what I could discern from just looking at the child or the occupational therapy practitioner. This moment for me was significant because it highlighted how AI could act as a force multiplier in occupational therapy. It showed me that AI could provide objective data that could be used to tailor or enrich occupational therapy sessions more precisely for each client's needs. And it also demonstrated the potential for AI to facilitate remote monitoring, making OT services more accessible for those who might not be able to attend in person or might be on a wait list for occupational therapy, which is what, you know, we are seeing quite a bit. And one last comment, because you can tell I'm so excited about AI. And again, you know, many people thought AI was ChatGPT. We know that that's a small little part, but that AI could help occupational therapy practitioners not only understand their clients better, but to reach and treat more clients effectively was transformational. It underscored the importance of integrating AI into occupational therapy to enhance the care that we provide and to provide outcomes while maintaining, and this is really important, the human touch that is so vital to occupational therapy.
Yeah, I love that concept of a force multiplier. I think that's what makes me excited, but also nervous. Like, we want to force multiply the best of ourselves, not the worst of ourselves. And I think that's where all the ethics come into this. Allison, what was your aha moment?
Yeah, so my aha moment, it was a sort of a slower build to it. Like in the pandemic, we were able to transition quite quickly to a telehealth platform, which was great. So we had not only the clients that we were currently seeing, but we had a number of clients who were in spaces where there weren't the option for a telehealth say, hey, can we transition to your space until there's an opportunity for us to do telehealth? And I really, that's when I really started to look at this idea of how technology can really answer continuity of care, not just being able to access larger populations and populations with barriers to access, but also how we can provide continuity of care for, you know, when clients are in spaces of transportation difficulty, or you know, maybe just in a new home for a little bit. They've moved and they're living with grandma for a little bit, and that's a little bit farther to commute in. And so we started to look at this idea of, you know, what is it? How do we manage this? But at the same time, I saw my clinicians feeling incredibly burnt out with the idea of how difficult it was to understand how to transform and regulate their treatment sessions on a telehealth platform. So I was seeing the problem. I was introduced to this idea of we have something where we know we can reach greater numbers of consumers, but at the same time, we're being overwhelmed by the additional complexity that it brings to us. And then along the line, I was introduced to Koro. Karen had said, hey, have you ever seen this product? I think it's really unique. And it was there that the aha moment sort of screamed at us. What we saw was not just an opportunity to make our session a little bit more efficient, give us this space of integrating some type of clinical intervention, facilitating care, while also giving ourselves a little bit of that opportunity to be an observer versus an actor in the intervention. But then on top of it, we were given this space of incredible knowledge and information. And that knowledge and information shared with us those pieces of aha for each kiddo that we had never known before. Like, this child doesn't have bilateral upper extremity weakness. This child's fatiguing out their right arm because they have less upper extremity weakness. How do we transform the rest of the session to address that very small detail to our eye, but large detail to the child's participation and performance? And so that's when we got really excited. And then to see all of the clinicians working with me at my clinic really excited, it culminated into, oh my goodness, this can really transform our practice to a better space.
When I thought about AI entering occupational therapy, I was so focused on it coming into documentation support first. And I thought that this clinical decision support, treatment support would be way down the line. So I honestly was really shocked to hear that you were using Koro to see the website, to see what's out there already. I just want to hear a little bit more, Allison, like from your clinic owner brain, how are you using this tool? Can you tell us a little bit more about it? I feel like listeners probably aren't immediately oriented to it. Give us a little more orientation and what you're seeing in the clinic.
Yeah, this is great. So Koro is an app that can go on any smart product. So an iPhone or the Samsung phone or an iPad, any of these products. And what it does is it engages a child in play on the app. The play is a really fun story about journeying into outer space. The child becomes an astronaut. But what it does is it has a variety of different skills that it is both building as well as assessing in the child for us. So we're looking at things like bilateral control or bilateral arm use, but we're also looking at things like inhibition. So is the child able to inhibit or prevent additional or excessive body movement while they're performing? At the same time, though, because the camera is very much active in the very present moment, when the child starts to go into a positioning or a movement style that's so off from what we want them to be doing, the app itself will pause, ask the child to come back to the mirror, get back into the right space. So we're also in a place where not only is it giving this ability for the child to practice a skill, it's also giving us feedback about that child's performance in this skill. Like, wow, to me, it looked like they did outstanding. But what the camera is able to tell me is actually there was a lot of excessive core movement. And so we need to think about why they were using some additional body muscles to do that movement. But then on top of it, it's not allowing the child to stay in a prolonged period of time in doing it in a way that's inaccurate, or allowing them a lot of time to perform it with excessive movement. So we have this great culmination of being able to really ensure that the child is being engaged in some of the activities like balance, bilateral coordination, fine motor pitch, and being able to see that they're engaging in those activities, but also that they're not able to engage in them in a wrong position for any long period of time. So what it's done for us is we use it in the clinic with the child. So it's a component of the session. It's a brief gameplay. We might play 8 minutes, maybe up to 10 minutes, maybe even only 7 in the beginning, right? Giving us a little bit of time, even though with that piece too, to cognitively download information without having so much cognitive effort in intervening, observing, recognizing, giving directions. And so it actually gives us a little bit of space of rest in our intervention session while the child is really participating in something meaningful. But then the Qlo app can be transferred to a parent or caregiver's phone. We can do it at home, and I get to see the data of how they're doing it at home. What does that look like when they do it in the home environment versus my environment? And then we have some of our clinicians implementing it in the school setting. What does it do for them when they're in the school setting and doing this? How does their performance on a test look afterwards? How can they color, draw, follow directions after a session that had some core integration? But no matter where I do it, I know that that child is always going to be encouraged and able to perform the activity in the just right. They're never going to spend too much time doing it in a way that is accommodating or not as efficient or not correct. So it's building the skill, but also sharing information to me. And it's actually helping us to say, this week, you know what? We thought that we needed to do more on those fine motor, those finger skills, but it looks like bilateral coordination is what really needs some help. So it's constantly informing and infusing what we're going to do next week, what we're going to refer, what type of accommodations are necessary. And it's giving us that real-time feedback in different environments so we know exactly, precisely what we need to do next and what we need to recommend next.
I have like a million follow-up questions, and we'll get to some of them. But I think I want to swing it to you, Karen. I know that you're doing some research on this, so I'm curious what the research questions that came to your mind were and what you're looking at from the research perspective.
Yeah, thank you. And just for your listeners, if they want to at the same time look at the Qoro website, there's one that's specific for occupational therapy, and that's ot.qoro, Qoro.ai. And I'll encourage them to look there to get a visual of what Allison was describing. So I'm very excited, and I'll start first talking about the research, and I'd like to also share what we're doing in academia too at Boston University. So right now, we started a feasibility study to investigate the use of Qoro AI, that platform, in traditional occupational therapy intervention with children that we've put in the category of developmental challenges. So Allison was describing some of those, fine motor, gross motor, dyspraxia, executive functioning challenges such as that. We're in two clinics. We're at Allison's Capable Kids in Pennsylvania, and we're also at Gallant Therapy Services in Maine. It's a randomized control trial, so we have children in the experimental group, randomly assigned there, and in the control group. So what Allison was describing was the occupational therapy practitioner at her center has experimental, children in the experimental, and in the control. So I'll go over the experimental a little bit with you, a little bit more detail. So we have a pre-part of the research where there are assessments that we have the occupational therapy practitioner conduct, and then a mid, and then a post. And in the experimental group, when they're finished with that pre-evaluation, Coro is integrated in their everyday occupational therapy sessions. And at Capable Kids, it's once a week. And so the occupational therapy practitioner, and I do want to share that this Coro is really something we want to see occupational therapists using and occupational therapy assistants using. So you'll hear me always say OT practitioner. So the OT practitioner will be using it at the beginning of their session. Allison mentioned 6, 7, 8 minutes or so, approximately that, maybe a little bit more. They will be using this playful gaming of the astronaut and missions. And then the occupational therapy practitioner will do their everyday occupational therapy activities. At home, where we send children home with OT homework to reinforce what we're doing in the clinic, in the experimental group, we've asked parents to set up the environment so that their child can use Coro at home. And the Coro app is paired with the therapist's app in the clinic. And so the child, we can see how often they are using it. And again, Allison mentioned, you know, that just right challenge. And one of the challenges we have seen, and this is one of the questions that we're looking at, is will we see an improved child adherence to doing occupational therapy homework through using Coro? And will we, in general, see an increase in satisfaction and performance with the child using Coro as well, and cognitive and functional skills compared to our standard occupational therapy intervention? The control group has regular occupational therapy, and they're sent home with their occupational therapy regular homework. And so what we're looking at now is, do we see a difference? Importantly, too, is what is the occupational therapy practitioner feeling about using this app? And Allison mentioned it gives them a breathing room because we are dealing, you know, nationally with burnout. And in a pediatric clinic, you're seeing lots and lots of children back to back. And so if Coro is used, and I'll give you just an example, maybe the first 15 minutes or so of your occupational therapy session, it gives sort of a breathing room for the occupational therapy practitioner. The child is engaged. And again, we're all about pediatrics here and making sure that whatever we get as the results in our study are really letting us understand the use of this platform. I'd like to, if it's okay with you, to share what I'm doing in academia. And I'm very excited about this, as you can tell. My role at Boston University is the Associate Dean of Digital Learning and Innovation. And so I've been staying up to date with what's going on. And we, a small team, wrote a grant. And some of these faculty are Amy Lamb and Liat Gaffney-Latcher, Karen Duddy, and myself as occupational therapist. And we brought in a writing tutor, David Seacrest, and a data science and computer science undergraduate student to help create an online training that we can tailor to undergraduate and graduate students at our college, Sargent College. And we titled this Optimizing AI at the Intersection of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences. So we've broadened this to go beyond occupational therapy, but to look at other professions that are part of our college, which would be speech, physical therapy, nutrition as well and dietetics besides occupational therapy. So we have designed this to introduce knowledge about the origins of AI and basic literacy in AI. And that's been something that we're finding across the board at different universities. People don't know what is AI. You know, many think it's generative AI and going on to Copilot or OpenAI, ChatGPT, they'll learn. And so we want them to see the current and potential use, the ethics of practicing and using AI. What we've done is created interactive case studies that are integrating this interprofessional approach. And we're also having students create their own AI use cases. And from the post-test, we have results that enhance their knowledge, enhance their attitude, and they felt more competent in the ethical and responsible use of AI. So we're expanding this after this very successful pilot to creating a faculty version of that program training.
Yeah, I just wanted to share one of the things that has been really exciting with the research study is our clients' desire to participate. So we actually had clients, I mean, it was easy to get the yeses, but then we had clients who were so disappointed when they were randomized into the not receiving a group. And so it was really fun to hear that, yes, they were excited. They wanted to participate. They wanted to sign up, and they actually wanted to be randomized into the group that had Coro. So the acceptance was outstanding with our consumers.
Mm-hmm. That reflects everything I read too, where people are so willing to try it. There are concerns that they bring in, but not enough that those Trump not trying it. Like, I think we're all finding ways to adopt AI into our lives and see the benefit. And that's going to be true in our OT services as well. This gives me such a good sense of kind of logistically how AI is in both of your work. I want to hear a little bit just how you're processing all this change. And I want to start with you, Karen, and ask, does this change that we're seeing feel like anything else that's happened before in occupational therapy? It feels unprecedented to me. I think of how much money had to be invested in something like Coro, how much is being invested in our documentation examples. To me, it feels unprecedented. Does it feel that way to you?
Well, thank you for asking, Sarah. So I've been an occupational therapist since 1979. Do the math. It's been a long time, and the profession has changed over that time in many, 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 I'll just say many, many over and over again areas. So the potential impact of AI on occupational therapy for me reminds me of the introduction of assistive technology and adaptive equipment in occupational therapy. And just as these tools extended the capabilities of the occupational therapy practitioner and their clients and enriched it, I think AI also promises to further enhance or enrich the scope of occupational therapy. So yes, I can go back in time and say, I have seen it. But I think that what we're looking at here is just revolutionary. AI can offer personalized assessments. It can offer, virtual therapy. Allison was talking about telehealth. It can be predictive analytics. It's really revolutionizing client care outcome, for examples that we're seeing at Coro. Coro, in particular at Capable Kids and Gallant. I would like to just maybe talk just a little bit more that the core of occupational therapy still stays the same. We have compassionate care. It's irreplaceable by technology. So even though you know, I'm seeing these waves. What we do, our core is always going to be there, that personal touch. But AI is a tool that, when used wisely, can amplify the positive impact of occupational therapy on the lives of the people we serve.
Allison, we got to hear a little bit about how you're logistically using it in your clinic and to hear from your clinic owner perspective. Thinking of the national level, I've heard you say that you want us to be a go-to resource in this new arena of AI in healthcare. What exactly does that mean? Am I quoting you directly? Is that your hope? And what does that logistically look like for us?
Yeah, thank you for asking this, Sarah. I do. I want to see us as the profession in which has, for lack of better terms, and to boldly state, has perfectly integrated AI as the mechanism that supports, enhances, and walks alongside the occupational therapy professional. What I know from looking across the board nationally and having conversations in DC is that we are going to require a substantial shift in our healthcare system. The delivery of care in this one-to-one capacity it's not able to reach the amount of individuals who are really requiring care. And if we are truly going to move, which I believe we are, to a place of having greater focus on prevention or early stage intervention, then this is only going to increase the number of consumers of healthcare. Now, I also believe that occupational therapy is the key profession in prevention and early intervention care, because those two require the same thing: routine change, habit differences, right? And the integration of changes in our environment and any type of assistive technology use. So if we are the experts in that preventative and early intervention care, then we absolutely are going to be the individuals who are needed the most. And if we are needed the most, we are going to require a partner in being able to do this in an effective, efficient way that is also going to be something that grabs our consumers and says, it's easy and efficient for you as well. AI is how we're going to do that. AI is also how we are going to be able to show the world that outcomes only exist when occupational therapy is a member of that team. I worry because if we don't do that, there are other professions that might be able to mimic us or share in some of the great outcomes we can achieve with the help of AI. And so what I would love to see is occupational therapy taking hold of what is naturally ours, a collaboration with AI and utilizing it to demonstrate that in preventative and early intervention healthcare, OT plus AI is a necessity. I'd like to see us look at things like you must annually visit your PCP and your occupational therapy professional with AI training and use. And that together, that is your preventative participation in care. That is your value of knowing that we are building opportunities for you to be in a space of best wellness. And so my goal, and I don't think it's that far off, is to see us really ingrained into primary care, leaders in primary care, because we can effectively use the collaboration with AI.
One of my fears around the new AI platforms that we're going to see come out is that they're going to push us towards like a biomechanical home exercise program. I think in some ways, those can be the easiest things to measure. And that's where, when I also involve like the PT realm into my mind. I just kind of see that being a focus because, I don't know, that feels like the easiest application. But what I hear you saying is you're talking about a whole shift in our healthcare towards prevention. That does not sound easy. How do we go towards your vision versus the easy biomechanical home exercise program vision that we know doesn't work, but we're still like drawn to because there's concrete numbers there. And there's a, that's where we've been.
Yeah. So another great question. You know, that's one of the things I love about Coro is that the individual who owns the company and has really invested the tremendous amount of not just financial resources, but personal intellect and personal resources into the development of Coro is married to an occupational therapist, right? And so he has really developed and designed with the principle of seeing that occupational therapy has to be a powerful influence in the development of the AI platform or app or whatnot. You know, so I see this as two things. One, I see it as our responsibility to start stepping up and being part of the teams that are developing. This is why Karen has done outstanding work with Coro. This is why we have agreed to say, let's bring it into the clinic. Let's research it, because we see that it was founded with OT principles. And then on top of it, we want to ensure that those OT principles remain a core component of it. So we need to step out of what we see as OT practice and start to recognize that being involved in these teams is part of OT practice. And the other part that I would say is that the concrete numbers are able to come through in complex ways when we see the development of the AI with occupational therapy. Here in Coro, I'm seeing numbers that tell me things like inhibition, how often they're inhibiting their movement. That's giving me true opportunity to expand beyond just, what's the exercise plan for inhibition, right? But is there occupational therapy treatment for inhibition? Absolutely, right? And so if we start to gear towards what are we, AI knows how to measure more than just the degree of extension. AI is a brilliant tool that with sensors can measure things like when is an individual experiencing stress? When is an individual experiencing excitement, right? These are the very things that will make OT amazing, is that that's what we're measuring too. When is the individual stressed and how do we quick jump in to adapt and modify the activity to reduce the stress and increase the participation? If we walk alongside the development of AI, then AI can be developed into a tool that's more than just a home exercise measurement, but it will require that it can never be done without us either. So whereas Coro gives you outstanding opportunities to practice great skills and grow developmental milestones in the child and give great information, what Coro doesn't do is transform that into how a child participates in every environment in a meaningful, purposeful way that's successful. We do that. So we have to be willing to not only step in and say we're willing to use it, step in and say we're willing to be part of the development, but then step in and recognize we still have to use our lens because it's a collaboration, not a replacement.
Yeah, it feels like every OT practitioner, where they are, needs to start visioning how do they want AI to be used in their setting and to be vocal about that and to find the right people to say that to. We can't be passive recipients of what's handed to us. We need to be vocal about co-creating this future. And we are a powerful block that needs to mobilize. If we're going to be leaders in this arena, it seems like we also need to be leaders in creating policies, creating safeguards, because there are privacy concerns. There's just unprecedented amounts of data. And it feels like our systems of safeguarding, I'm thinking like ACOAT, AOTA, our academic institutions, they're already under so much pressure already with the rate of change. Like, how do they keep up? Should I feel hope that they'll be able to evolve quickly enough? Like, this is changing every month. It feels different. How do these systems that are intended to change more slowly, how do they keep up and how do they give us the infrastructure to innovate?
Yeah, so part of that is, again, our responsibility to participate. So AOTA exists because of the amount of volunteers that are willing to step in and walk alongside staff to do the work. It also means engaging our state associations and saying, hey, how can we help to facilitate some of this happening? So really leaning in the idea that it is going to move and create the policy that we need when we do it through AOTA and our state associations, but they are going to need our help. They're going to need our help from the level of just saying, I'm willing to try it and write a letter to my legislator, or I'm willing to show up to a Hill Day event, all the way through to saying, I'm willing to be an expert who can give information towards development of a letter, or engage in an interview with a legislator, or be the person that might be testifying in front of a congressional hearing. We just a few years ago had Victoria Garcia Wilburn testify in front of U.S. Congress about the need for increasing funding for diversity. So the Allied Healthcare Workforce Diversity Act had testimony from an occupational therapist. She was a volunteer. She stepped in, she leaned in, she offered her personal experience as well as expertise to inform the development of policy. And out of everybody they heard that day, the speaker that day said to Victoria, wow, you have made your family proud. There was impact in her story. We are narrative as a professional. We know how to share the story with the data. And so this is going to require us being willing to say, I'll do it from small steps of taking a survey, or being willing to try it, or engaging in a webinar, listening to this podcast to learn more about it, all the way through to saying, I'm willing to be part of the policymaking process. I'll share that I hear from a lot of state associations, and I hear within AOTA, there's excitement. AOTA staff want to get behind this policy change. State associations want to get behind it because we have individuals in these spaces who are innovators and early adopters who say we need to get ahead of it. And so those working there are willing. We just need to be able to step up and walk alongside in our advocacy journeys to support that movement and change. And I'll say from a flipped perspective too, we are all in some capacity utilizing it. How many times has someone taken the information from a smartwatch and integrated it to either tell a client, hey, here's times when you need to get up and move around more. Oh my goodness, when we were practicing deep breathing, did you watch your heart rate go down, right? So this is, or even something as like, can you wear your smartwatch while you're sleeping? And we can look at how much time you were in REM sleep to adopt and modify that sleep routine, right? We're already using it. It's about sharing the stories. Let's share the stories. Let's be part of the advocacy wave, because the government is interested and policymakers are interested. We just have to share our narrative. And one final point on that is, there has been a lot of times that this type of data is collected in this way. So let's look to ways that HIPAA and other policies were protected in that. If we go and align with some of our speech colleagues, they've been using augmentative communication devices that have online capacities and registrations for a long time now. How How did that integrate with HIPAA, with FERPA, with some of our privacy laws and interactions? So we don't need to reinvent the wheel. Let's talk to some of our colleagues and see how we shift and make it apply to what we're doing.
OTs are such great storytellers. I know that from hosting a podcast, and I know they have that analytical side of the brain, and I can really see what you're talking about, Allison, of being leaders in sharing this story of moving us forward, of moving our regulations and policies forward. I'm thinking about, again, for individual practitioners, if we're going to be leaders, it's going to take a lot of moral courage because we're headed into so many unknowns. There are going to be things that go wrong. There's going to be unintended negative consequences. I think back to when I was a new practitioner and I was practicing under rug levels, which like incentivized you to give the clients like slightly more therapy, which was, I look back now and I'm like, that was unethical. And I knew that, and I didn't have the moral courage to say that to my boss. I definitely didn't have the moral courage to speak up on that. And I wanted to do the right thing. I don't know, how are we going to develop this new level of moral courage that we'll need? What's your like personal advice on that? How are you both doing that? I think of you as great leaders. How do we get the courage to speak up? Because we're going to need to speak up.
Yes. Sarah, thank you for sharing your own story, because moral courage is so important, particularly in the context of this rapidly evolving AI world. And I believe, and Allison touched on many of those points in your previous question, so I'll just reinforce some of those. It's really a personal commitment to continuous learning and ethical practice. And I teach ethics in one of my courses at Boston University, but I think it's a thread in all education and all practice. When, you know, in Massachusetts, to renew our license, we have to take a course in ethics. So that education is really important. Staying informed, keeping abreast of what's the latest development, and really understanding the implication for occupational therapy helps me participate and come up with a language, a story that I can tell about potential issues, and making an intentional decision, looking at the AOTA Code of Ethics and answering a question that we may not know the answer, but that can guide us. I think that's reflective practice, regularly reflecting on the work we're doing and the decisions we're making, really helps me personally stay in alignment with the ethical principles and professional standards, looking at the standards, talking to others, seeking diverse perspectives, like contacting colleagues from different backgrounds and specialty areas, sort of broadens my understanding of how AI might affect various populations that I may not have thought about that can help build my moral courage. Allison mentioned this, advocating for the ethical use. I think that's extremely important. And looking at advocating for systems that promote equity and justice in AI. We haven't talked about that as much, but that is so important. Supporting transparency, making sure that AI systems are transparent in their decision-making processes, the algorithm. You know, we've heard a lot about the algorithm with generative AI and some of the biases there. You know, really reflecting on the information we get and making sure we understand and identify these biases. I also believe we have to encourage accountability from the AI developers and users, and making sure we understand, and Allison reinforced that, we need to be part of that. We need to reach out to companies that are creating AI, just like Coro AI has occupational therapy practitioners working with them, developing their games, their platform. We need to be part of that. And finally, I think we need to empower our clients to involve them as stakeholders in the decision-making process, so that they also can express their rights and preferences and that that's respected. So these are all ways I think I'm personally and encouraging students and other practitioners to cultivate the moral courage. And we do need moral courage to speak up and to act when AI systems are not meeting the high standards required in occupational therapy.
And, you know, just to add to that, you know, I think Karen brings up something really incredible, and it's reflective practice, right? So sometimes there's ways and times when you know something isn't right, but it doesn't feel like you can just bring it up. So find the article and say, I'd love to have a, lunch, journal club, or, hey, I've really, you know, there's nothing wrong in utilizing a space of questioning as part of your moral courage, right? I don't understand this, or here's where I feel like I'm not providing an ethical level of care. Is there something we can do? So utilizing those questions of reflective practice as your platform or the beginning space in which to start the conversation, I think it would benefit us all to recognize, in general, people aren't trying to be unethical. And so sometimes it's about learning together. And it helps with that moral courage when we approach it from a space of maybe this individual or this system doesn't know either. And so how can we learn together? Is there something that we can do in a journal club that might illuminate where there's some ethical concerns? Is there a question I can ask that would build reflection in the system itself to say, oh, wait a minute, have we thought about that yet? And so sometimes moral courage is actually being willing to, like Karen said, be a reflective practitioner, but ask those questions out loud.
And not be frightened. I think that's really important, you know, to have our voice and to amplify our voice. Mm-hmm.
AI is hopefully going to augment the best of us. We need a safeguard against it augmenting our biases, against augmenting inequity. And as I'm processing that as an individual, I just feel every time I hear about AI, I feel this incredible pressure to be like, I need to learn more. I need to change everything about my life. I need to get rid of Netflix. Like, this is coming so fast. How do I get oriented? I feel a little overwhelmed. One of the last questions I want to ask is just personally, how are you all managing this onslaught of information emotionally and logistically? And what advice do you have for us?
I would love to share my advice as you're getting a feeling of this. I said, just like Allison said, it's keeping up with readings, you know, setting up a journal club, making sure that any of the educational opportunities that are out there, that you're a participant, an active participant, not sitting back passively. For me, I am excited about this prompting growth in our profession. I encourage people to really tell their stories, be part of it, raise their hand when someone says, who's interested in being in a research project, or who's interested in taking a capstone student, who's interested in artificial intelligence. You know, be part of that narrative, be part of the revolution. Stand up and say, I want to participate, and I want to be the person who is playing this story, making sure this story is ethical. I want to be the one who's responsible for this and to grow the profession. We have a pivotal point in occupational therapy to be the primary profession who is using occupational therapy and AI together. And I hope with this podcast, we're challenging your listeners to want to be part of that.
Yes. And you know, I would build off of that. So, You know, I think there are people that do incredible work for us, like Sarah. I'll tell you, when I want to learn something about something new, I look to OT Potential. Do they have any information? Is there a podcast on it, right? We have, you know, like, does AOTA have a position paper about it, right? Like, we have these trusted resources where we don't have to spend the time going through all the readings to find the right one. We have people like you who have done this, and we can trust that what you're moving forward is the space to learn. So find those trusted places and utilize what they have, the work they have done, and saying, okay, now I can minimize how much I have to investigate. I just need to find out where it is in the trusted places and learn from it. You know, AOTA has a number of webinars with incredible experts related to AI. There's going to be a webinar coming up that we're going to do through Coro. And so, you know, there's even some information that you can find there. And your podcasts and OT Potential always has the evidence-based components of practice, right? So go to those trusted resources, and that minimizes some of it. And the other part I would say is, this is our opportunity to be a part of the transformation of healthcare and healthcare delivery. We're going to have to learn it no matter what. But if we learn it now, then we can be part of really designing what it looks like. Look, we weren't part of the design of PDPM. And whether you are fully in support of PDPM or you're not, or you're somewhere in the middle, regardless, if you're in a skilled nursing facility, you have to read about it, learn about it, and bill under it. AI is going to transform, and it's going to be the transformation of healthcare, not just nationally, but globally. We're seeing it really be implemented and integrated into policies across the world. So let's get involved now. Let's challenge ourselves to raise our hand, to take the capstone student, to participate in the reflection, because if we do it now, then the transformation in healthcare delivery gets to be AI and OT versus the transformation in healthcare delivery is AI and another healthcare profession that was willing to take on. So, and my final thing is, there's something my father told me years ago, and he would say to me, Allison, remember when you enter into the field of healthcare, we have always, since the beginning of healthcare, defined medicine as a practice. Don't be afraid of your failures, because your failures are what inform us how to do better. And if we don't fail, we won't change. And if we don't change, we're actually not practicing what we were trained to do. So don't be afraid of the failures. We're practicing occupational therapy. And when we meet those failures, I'll just refer to one more person. Abe Saffer at AOTA always says, there is no one who knows how to fail better than the occupational therapy professional, because that's where we thrive. That's where we realize, okay, what do? We watch a client in participation in an activity, maybe cooking. We see where they fail, and then we design how to do it differently so they don't next time. So don't fear the failures. Recognize that in the failures, we're the ones that everybody needs. We're the ones that know how to analyze the task, determine where that failure happened, and change it. So it's exciting and it's scary, but it's not new to our practice. This is what we've done for years. This time we're just encouraging everybody to be the primary partner in it.
This was exciting to answer the questions that you posed to us, and we want to keep this narrative going. So if anybody wants to continue speaking with us, just reach out and let's start that conversation to make this a revolution for occupational therapy with AI.
Yeah, I think before this conversation, I was feeling like I need to stay up to 3 a.m. every night and become a computer scientist. But what I've heard is We need to be storytellers. We need to be collaborators. We need to cast a vision. I know OTs have ideas for how things can be better, and things are going to be changing. So let's be active in that change. This has been very inspirational, very helpful for me. And I just want to thank you both for your leadership and for being here today.
Thank you for having us. Thank you for this opportunity.
Yes, thank you, Sarah. I also want to say thank you. The service that OT Potential provides for us to be able to be incredible practitioners is irreplaceable. So thank you.
Wow, you all, this episode stretched my mind and also my emotional range. I am so excited for our future, but I also feel this strong call to action to be collaborating and supporting each other like never before. I'm going to be sharing the resources that we mentioned in this podcast in our show notes. And as always, I really want to hear what your thoughts are on this topic. There is just so much to unpack here, and we really need to be sharing. If you are a casual listener, we'd love to hear a review from you. You can now review us on Google from our homepage, or we always appreciate your thoughts on our YouTube video. But the best place to really discuss the implications of this is in the OT Potential Club, and I'll be watching for your comments in our forum. The OT Potential Club is also where you will go to earn a CEU certificate for your time today. To earn the certificate, you can head to otpotential.com and either sign in or sign up for the OT Potential Club. Once you are in there, you can take a 5-question test, and when you pass, we will generate a certificate for your time today. Okay, I just want to thank you so much for joining us for this conversation. I hope this podcast helps keep you informed and inspired as an OT professional. Take care, and we'll talk next time.